Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The Dutch-led investigation into the downing of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 released its first report yesterday. Their conclusion was that a Buk missile delivered from Russia was responsible for the downing of the civilian airliner. But should this now be taken as established fact, or has the joint investigative team been allowed to fabricate or accept fabricated evidence? The Senate has overwhelmingly overturned President Obama's veto on a bill that would allow U.S. citizens to sue foreign governments for terrorism on U.S. soil. What are the ramifications if 9/11 survivors and family members are soon able to sue Saudi Arabia? 15 years have passed since the 25,000 people demonstration joined together in the first post-September 11th mass action in Washington, D.C., just weeks after the attack. The protest was the first action coordinated by the newly established Answer Coalition and inaugurated a new 21st century anti-war movement. But first, we turn to the MH17 investigation. We are joined to analyze this report and its implications by Ray McGovern, a former CIA analyst and now political activist and journalist. Welcome back, Ray.
Thanks. Thanks, Brian.
Let's start with your reactions to the report that was released yesterday. Were the conclusions a surprise, and do they have validity, or are there too many questions about this investigative process?
There remain many, many questions. One of the prime suspects is running the investigation. That happens to be the country called Ukraine. This is really a travesty on a real investigation. How can you have one of the prime suspects not only running the investigation, but hosting the various investigators from other countries who, when they go home, they say, oh, you know, those are Ukrainians were so helpful in providing this, that, and the other thing. We didn't have much work at all. We're just treated royally when we come to Kiev. The whole thing is a farce. You know, the real questions remain to be answered. For example, 3 days after the shoot down was July 17, 2014. 3 days later, talk about rush to judgment. John Kerry got up on all these Sunday talk shows and said it was the Russians. It was Russian missiles. It was the Russians. It was a pro-separatist Russians. Okay, blame the whole thing on the Russians. Now, he said on NBC's Face the Nation, we have the imagery. We picked up that imagery and we know the trajectory. We know where it came from. We know the timing. And later he said, we know that the aircraft went down as soon as the trajectory and the targeting hit the aircraft. Well, that's really nice. Where's the beef? Where's that evidence? Last I heard, that evidence was not given to anyone, not even to the Dutch Safety Board, and not even to the father of one of the passengers who happened to be an American. So the question really remains, if there is this evidence, imagery, trajectory, all kinds of technical evidence, which parenthetically add, there must be, given the saturation coverage, U.S. satellites in that area. But why doesn't John Kerry adduce that evidence? Why doesn't he show that he wasn't stretching the truth? We don't say lying in Washington. He wasn't prevaricating. He really has that evidence. He needs to show that. Otherwise, people will say, well, gosh.
Let me ask you, of course, that is very important, the point that you're making, because this was, as you said, right after the shootdown on July 17, 2014. 298 people were killed. I mean, a real disaster for all of those people, for their families. It was over the eastern part of Ukraine. The context was that there was a civil war going on. The civil war was by the new government in Ukraine that took power following a fascist-led or neo-fascist or semi-fascist-led coup d'etat on February 22, 2014. A civil war had started and thousands of people died eventually. But the Ukrainian government was actually bombing people, its own people in the eastern region, people who are described in the Western media as pro-Russian or separatists. So I hear you. John Kerry, a rush to judgment, went right on TV. Let's look at what countries are represented on the joint investigative team, because the media now is treating this 2 years later as the definitive word. The countries are the Netherlands, Belgium, Australia, Malaysia, and Ukraine. One, you made the point that Ukraine is a suspect, so why are they involved? But what about Russia's involvement? They were denied.
Yeah, their evidence hasn't been included, and they're complaining loudly about that. One also curious aspect of John Kerry's presentations there 3 days after the shootdown was his pointing out that social media are a, quote, extraordinarily useful tool, end quote.
That's amazing.
Anyone who knows about social media. But the question is, a tool for what? And the fellows there, the Bellingcat guys and the Higgins and all those other folks, they're shown to be completely off base in what they've reconstructed. My colleague Robert Parry has gone through some of the details of their so-called videos and shown them to be, at best, completely inconclusive. So if that is all that John Kerry and the Dutch, who I would add are the most subservient of all our allies in Europe, and that's really saying something, and the Ukrainians are pretty much the center of the investigation, you know, how can anyone take this very seriously?
Russia says that it has radar evidence that shows that the plane was shot down from a village held by Ukrainian military forces, meaning governmental forces, not rebel forces. But the joint investigative team says that it has audio of rebels that proved otherwise. Can we expect that this alleged audio will be released?
Well, you know, I would expect that it should be, so far they haven't. It's, 2 years plus since the shootdown. Nothing gives me to believe that Kerry's supposed evidence or this will be released. Instead, we have social media. It's really, really sad because we're talking about 298 people being killed because of this. Now, how does this play into the larger picture? Well, more than three decades ago, when I was on active duty as a CIA analyst, something very, very similar happened. On September 1, 1983, KAL-007, a Korean airliner, was shot down over Sakhalin in the Soviet Union. Now, it had been preceded by a U.S. spy plane, and it's very clear that the Russian air controllers thought, oops, here's another U.S. spy plane, the more so since it didn't respond to warning shots or, you know, waving the wings or anything else. So the order was given to shoot it down. Now, it turned out to be a passenger plane. We knew from intercepted communications that the pilot thought and the ground control thought they were shooting down a spy plane. They didn't know, in other words, the KAL-007, which was completely off radio and off everything, was a passenger plane. Now, what do we do? Well, the State Department, now this, mind you, September 1st, 1983, the whole game in town there was to impress Ronald Reagan about how evil the Soviet Empire was. And so what happened to the 50-minute audio tape that we had from ground control to pilot and so forth? It was trimmed down to 8 minutes. All signs or indications that it was a mistake, that it was not intentional, were removed, and we got at the UN a doctored transcript, 8.5 minutes, prepared to show that, as the word went, the Soviets did this deliberately. Time magazine's cover, murder in the sky, a barbaric action. Now, barbaric, and that's the word that Samantha Powers used at the UN earlier this or just last week. Now, what's the point here? The point here is that it was to blacken the Russians, and it was used. It was used masterfully. Now, if it's just a propaganda, well, that doesn't matter, okay? There were serious consequences to this. Not only was the propaganda war started on the Soviet Union under Reagan, but there were all kinds of war exercises planned and conducted. I refer specifically to Abel Archer, which was the first week in November 1983. Now, why do I mention that? Well, because that was a 10-day NATO exercise that simulated a conflict escalation, a unique format, coded communications, radio silences. It was so realistic that the Russians thought it was for real, okay? Now, we know that the Russians thought it was for real, well, the way they reacted. And only my colleagues, Mel Goodman and others, were able to go to Casey, Bill Casey, and persuade him, the first and only time they were able to get him to change his mind, go down to the White House and say, look, the Soviets are really worried. It looks like we might have a nuclear exchange if you don't call off this exercise. Reagan understood that, and he called it off. What am I saying here? I'm saying that we're in a similar period of heightened propaganda, which has no rhyme or reason from the Russians' point of view. We have a period where they tried to cooperate with us in Syria, and what did they get? Well, Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, just 2 days ago said, you know, I don't know if we can trust anyone. I certainly don't trust Kerry 100% anymore. He told my boss, he told Putin, that President Obama was behind the deal that we worked out. But as Lavrov said, apparently the Department of Defense does not obey the commander-in-chief. Wow. Well, that's exactly what happened, as we all know. It's very, very clear that that ceasefire or limited ceasefire was scuttled by the attack on Syrian government troops.
So, Ray, let me jump in here. We have about 5 minutes left. I mean, I think your history here is extremely important. What happened with KAL 007, the shoot down of a civilian airliner by the Soviet Union September 1st, 1983. I remember it vividly. The headlines of the main New York newspapers, at least the tabloids, was don't let the Soviet don't let Gromyko land at Kennedy Airport to come to the United Nations. In other words, it was a full court press on the Soviet Union. It led to immense tensions. It led, as you said, to near war. And of course, you know, with the placement of nuclear missiles in Europe that had a 6-minute flight time to Soviet targets, the possibility of nuclear war is real. It can't be underestimated. The Russians now are no longer believing that they can trust the United States. Now, there was a major general, Igor Konashenkov. He said 2 days ago he was adamant about the fact that no buck system was delivered from Russia into Ukraine. 2 days ago, he said, quote, they're going on the record here. No Russian missile systems, including Buk, ever crossed the Russian-Ukrainian border. Now, that's after the Russian foreign ministry also decried the fact, and the foreign ministry spokesperson, to this day, the investigators continue to ignore the overwhelming evidence provided by the Russian side, despite the fact that Russia is the only side that submits accurate information and constantly discloses new data. I mean, what's the politics here? I mean, why drive this into the point of complete estrangement, confrontation, tension? What's the end game?
Wish I knew. Brian, I really wish I knew. It doesn't make any sense. You know, unless you go back to the old saw, which is true enough, that peace is very bad for business. And war and tensions, very good for the arms trade, which the Pope called the blood-soaked arms traders. But unless you go way back to that, who profits from an almost nuclear exchange with Russia? No one does. And so why our mass media fall in step now, just as they did back in 1983 that we just discussed? Ted Koppel. Here's Ted Koppel on Nightline.
This is one of those occasions where there's no difference between what is churned out by the U.S. government and the commercial broadcasting networks. Well, that's right. That's exactly right. They're stenographers. That's what they do. Now, one last thing on this. There was a high-level State Department official who wrote a book, okay? And he was the one that doctored, or was given the doctored transcript down from 50 minutes down to 8 minutes to show that the Soviets in those days deliberately in a outrageous, a barbaric thing shot down
and killed 298 passengers. Now, what he says was this. He wrote a book, and the book he called, I have it somewhere in my mind, but what he said was, you know, he drew an ironic lesson from his involvement in all this, and rather than being contrite, he said, and he wrote this. This is the senior State Department official quote. The moral of the story is that all governments, including our own, lie when it suits their purposes. The key is to lie first. Well, I have to tell you that Kerry, whether it's about sarin attacks in Syria, whether it's about moderates winning in Syria, or whether it's about a whole bunch of things, he has shown to not be telling the truth. So much so that President Putin, as Obama arrived in Moscow for a summit on September 6, 2013, he allowed himself to say in public, referencing Kerry, "Он врет, он знает, что врет, это печально." He lies, he knows he's lying, and this is really sad. Now, Obama could not counter that because he knew that that happened to be true. Kerry had lied about the moderate strength in Syria, and he had also lied about the sarin gas.
That's the voice of Ray McGovern. Those who lie first win. I guess that's the idea, Ray. In other words, you capture the media, you capture the headlines, you capture the narrative. We're completely out of time. We've been talking with Ray McGovern about the Dutch report on the shootdown of Malaysia Airlines civilian airliner Flight 17. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The U.S. House of Representatives and Senate have overwhelmingly overturned President's veto on a bill that would allow U.S. citizens to sue foreign governments for terrorism on U.S. soil. Will 9/11 survivors and family members soon be able to sue Saudi Arabia? And what does that mean for U.S. foreign policy? We are joined by Sam Sachs of the District Sentinel and co-host of Radio Sputnik's Unanimous Dissent. Welcome, Sam.
Hey, Brian. Good to be on.
Thanks for joining. Let's start with your reaction to the House and Senate vote to overturn President Obama's veto. I mean, they were big votes in the Senate. It was 97-1. Republican Senator John Cornyn said, in our polarized politics of today, this is pretty much close to a miraculous occurrence. Why was the vote so overwhelming across both parties, and what's its impact?
Well, it is a bit surprising, the numbers. I guess it is worth mentioning that this bill was passed earlier by unanimous consent in both the House and the Senate. It was by voice vote. Nobody objected to it. That was before the president vetoed it. So now that it was passed, again, 97-1 in the Senate, Harry Reid was the only senator to vote against it. And then the House passed it 348-77, shows that there were some lawmakers who did have second thoughts after they chose not to object the first time around. There was a fierce lobbying campaign by the White House. You saw the Defense Secretary Ashton Carter come out and say this will harm national security if JAST is approved. You had Secretary of State John Kerry say the same thing. You had the CIA director come out and say the same thing. So you had all the sort of head honchos of the Obama administration try and push lawmakers, a lot of Democratic lawmakers, to join them in defeating this. If Democrats would have joined together, they could have sustained the veto, but they chose not to. I think because on the one hand, you have what optically looks very good and is a noble fight, which is to represent victims of terrorism, particularly the 9/11 families. You saw people like Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi reference those people when they're discussing why they will act against President Obama's wishes and override his veto. So that was a pretty powerful force to keep JASTA on track to passage. Also, I think this is a sign that Saudi Arabia's influence in Washington, D.C., in Congress, is starting to diminish. You have this vote, and you also had just recently about a week ago, had a measure in the Senate, a resolution that would have condemned a $1.15 billion arms deal that's scheduled to go to Saudi Arabia. The resolution condemning it didn't pass, but 27 senators stood up and voted in support of it. You know, we've We've had a lot of arms deals go to Saudi Arabia during Obama's administration. None of them have been condemned. Now you have 27 senators standing up and condemning
them. Yeah, I mean, Saudi Arabia is not democratic. It's a monarchy. It's a blood monarchy. It is also a fountainhead for Islamic extremism and jihadi ideology. As long back as Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, the U.S. government said, Reagan said himself, there will not be a revolution in Saudi Arabia. This was after the Iranian Revolution, meaning Saudi Arabia played such a pivotal role as a partner for the United States, as an extension, really, in some ways, of American influence in this resource-rich and geostrategically important part of the world, that nothing the Saudis did, no matter how onerous and egregious it was enough to make the United States stand against it. But Saudi Arabia really is the elephant in the room here, because recently President Obama allowed the 28 pages of secreted parts of the 9/11 Commission report that had to do with Saudi Arabia be released publicly. And the issue is, did Saudi Arabia, did the Saudi intelligence agencies, were they connected to the 9/11 hijackers? Did Saudi Arabia or some parts of the Saudi regime play a role in this attack? And if so, why has the United States up until now not gone after them?
Well, you make an interesting point of how, I guess, Saudi Arabia has fallen to a certain extent. It was this untouchable ally. And now here we are today, you know, questioning what role they played in 9/11 in condemning arms sales to the country. So the 28 pages, when they were released, there are quite a bit of few interesting threads that, if lawsuits were brought and if those were tugged on through discovery, who knows what might be found. It doesn't seem like the FBI was, or federal investigators were, appropriately investigating a lot of these things at the time. Even the 28 pages recognizes that there seemed to be a blind spot among federal investigators when it came to Saudi Arabia.
I think those 28 pages actually reveal that up until September 11th, there was no counterintelligence program by U.S. intelligence agencies against Saudi Arabia. In other words,
right,
it was
inconceivable to them. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's amazing. And yet 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi citizens.
Right. And in the 28 pages detail other strange things like financial payments that went to individuals who were associated with some of the hijackers, phone numbers that were included from the hijackers' phones that belonged to various. There was like some sort of security company for Prince Bandar, Saudi ambassador. There was also a story of what federal investigators believed was a test run for 9/11, in which two individuals tried to access the cockpit. They were on tickets that were paid for by the Saudi Arabian government. So there are a lot of things there that raise suspicions and might give grounds for 9/11 victims and their families to bring suit against the government of Saudi Arabia. But I will add, and this is the important thing to talk about when it comes to JASTA, is that just because this is law now, and just because families have this ability to launch lawsuits against Saudi Arabia, doesn't mean they will actually succeed in doing so. And that's because the legislation does include a major loophole in its effectiveness that allows the Obama administration, or the Secretary of State, or the Secretary of Defense, to certify that there are good faith negotiations to resolve any disagreements or any suits with a foreign government. And that would allow the administration to block any lawsuits if they can certify that. So,
well, if they have that loophole, they're going to drive a truck through that loophole each and every time.
Exactly, which makes it plays to why is the Obama administration making such a big stink out of this now? Josh Earnest said that this is the most embarrassing thing that the Senate has done since 1983. 1983 was just some, it was like some veto of some land deal in Oregon during the Reagan administration. I'm not sure why that stuck out so much in Josh Earnest's brain, but his point was that the senators have abdicated their role of protecting the interests of the American people, and that now that JASTA has passed, even if, I suppose, the Obama administration can stop any lawsuit it wants because of this loophole, but just the fact that the legislation was passed, it could lead to other countries deciding to do similar things and bring the U.S. to court.
Yeah, because we have a limited amount of time, I want to cover a few more important topics, but of course we'll have to do them sort of succinctly and briefly. Why did the Justice Department oppose it? Why did the Justice Department send a letter to Congress saying, if you pass this bill, it's going to harm the interests and perhaps the lives of American military personnel?
The opposition is twofold. I think what the Justice Department is getting at there is that the U.S. is involved in some things that a lot of people might disagree with abroad. I'm speaking of drone warfare, renditions, security assistance to strongmen and governments that abuse human rights, things like this that could leave the U.S. vulnerable to lawsuits in other countries. If the U.S. decides that they're going to strip sovereign immunity from a bunch of foreign countries, those countries could decide they're going to strip sovereign immunity from the U.S. and allow lawsuits to proceed in that way. A couple other things, there's fears that Saudi Arabia might withdraw $750 billion it has in U.S. assets and treasuries, that's threatened to do that as a part of this if this legislation was passed. The other thing that the administration has pointed to that they object to is that there's already a process, they argue, to declare a country a state sponsor of terrorism and strip their immunity from them. The State Department or the Treasury Department, I think it's the State Department actually, has the state sponsors of terrorism list. Currently, there are just three countries on that list. It's Iran, Syria, and I believe Sudan is the third country that's on the list. And it's a fairly politically motivated list is the problem with that. I mean, you had Cuba on the list for the longest time until just 2015. But what this would do, what JASTA does, is instead of leaving it up to the executive to determine who's a state sponsor of terrorism, it leaves it up to judges around the country who get these lawsuits, look at the facts, and determine whether or not a state sponsored an act of terrorism. And if so, they can sue that country, and that country thus loses its sovereign immunity.
That's important because you mentioned Iran is on the foreign terrorism list. Routinely, Iran is sued for terrorist actions, even actions that it obviously has almost no connection to or no connection to. And yet Iran, and because they're on the terrorism list, and Iran never defends themselves in court. And then the courts routinely hand these gigantic settlements against Iran. And then the U.S. government or the court orders the freezing or seizure of assets of Iran in order to perhaps pay compensation for those, the awards, the legal awards. It's completely political.
Yeah, well, and I mean, there is no international law essentially here. I mean, even if suits are allowed to proceed and Saudi Arabia is found liable for X amount of dollars, they don't have to pay. I mean, no one's forcing, there's no international body that's going to force them to pay. If the U.S. is found guilty in all these courts around the world, there is no entity that will force them to pay these suits. So, you know, that gets, I guess, to the whole sort of charade of this whole thing that, you know, lawmakers are standing up on behalf of 9/11 families and victims of terrorism. But in reality, it's a bit of a false hope. One, if you can even get the legislation past the Obama administration stopping it, or whoever the president is at the time in the future. And two, whether or not if you can get a judgment, if a country is even going to pay it.
But the Saudis really do care about it because governments care about international public opinion.
Yes, exactly. Like, yeah. That's the only kind of force that can get people to comply or governments
and
to comply.
And you can see like in South Africa when there were sanctions and boycotts, it really made a huge difference, even though the South African economy was, you know, the dominant economy. Saudi Arabia has to do trade. It has to have economic intercourse with the rest of the world. And of course, it's sensitive about politics. I want to go back to the 28 pages that were declassified. And you alluded to it, but I want to ask you more about it. While in the United States, this is from the report, the 9/11 Commission report. While in the United States, some of the September 11th hijackers were in communication and received support or assistance from individuals who may be connected to the Saudi government. There is information primarily from FBI sources that at least two of those individuals were alleged by some to be Saudi intelligence officers. If any of this is even remotely true, and that turned out to be the case, and that got brought out, as you said, in discovery, in legal court, in legal actions, I mean, that could rip apart the Saudi government's even sort of frail efforts towards legitimacy in international politics.
Yeah, it could, and it would also raise a lot of questions about what U.S. foreign policy has been up to over the last 15 years post 9/11, in which we have invaded almost every country around Saudi Arabia or in the region, or at least dropped bombs. Or conducted drone missions or bolstered security or, you know, allied with some government against everybody except Saudi Arabia.
Everybody but Saudi Arabia. And then when you think about it, Osama bin Laden is Saudi. Of course, he had a falling out with the main part of the Saudi royal family, but not probably all of it. But then you have ISIS. I mean, ISIS is the targeted entity, so-called Islamic State, Daesh. Obviously, they got a lot of money, a lot of weapons, a lot of support, even fighters from the Saudi government for their campaign in Iraq, their campaign in Saudi or in Syria. U.S. says they're at war against ISIS. They're at war against Al-Qaeda in Syria and Iraq. But you have the Saudi government at the same time, the American ally, supporting these forces.
That's true. And they're also engaged in a very brutal war in Yemen right now. That is one of the reasons why there were so many senators opposing the arms deal over there. You've had a Congressman Ted Lieu of California, a Democrat, say that the U.S. is basically aiding and abetting war crimes by providing military hardware. And the U.S. has increased its refueling missions above Yemen in support of Saudi Arabia by about 60% just since February. So, yeah, this is an actor in the region that, by most objective standards, the U.S. shouldn't be an ally with or dealing with, at least if we're going to uphold our what we claim to uphold.
Purported values.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, but in fact, of course, Saudi has been a key link to American politics. After the Iranian Revolution, when Ronald Reagan said Saudi Arabia will not have a revolution, it obviously seemed to be for the United States absolutely essential to have Saudi Arabia on its side. When you look back now since September 11th, 15 years later, it seems like American influence in the region is coming, in a way, undone. Because, and again, if the Saudis stopped buying American weapons, even for a little while, that would have a huge impact on the armaments industry.
Yes, and the armaments industry understands that very well. That resolution I keep mentioning that condemned the arms deal to Saudi Arabia, some of the senators that voted to carry that arms deal forward to preserve that arms deal are some of the biggest recipients of these contractors. General Dynamics stands to gain the most from this specific weapons deal, and they have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on senatorial campaigns just this year. So they have an interest in preserving the status quo for sure. I mean, Saudi Arabia is a client state of theirs, so they want to preserve policies that allow that money to keep flowing into them.
Yeah, it's the irony of ironies. The Senate and House stand up against the president, overturn for the first time in the President Obama's almost eight years, a presidential veto.
They couldn't get Obamacare, but they got...
Yeah, the runner-up, we couldn't overturn health care, so let's go for Saudi Arabia. That's it. Okay, great victory, but with a big, big loophole, but maybe not big enough for Saudi Arabia and its sensibilities.
We'll see.
We've been talking with Sam Sachs of the District Sentinel and co-host of Radio Sputnik's Unanimous Dissent. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. 15 years have passed since 25,000 people joined the first major anti-war demonstration of the post-9/11 period in Washington, D.C., just weeks after the attacks. The protest was the first action coordinated by the newly established Answer Coalition, and it inaugurated a new 21st century anti-war movement that grew into a movement of millions during the next 2 years. We are joined on the phone from Washington, D.C. by Sarah Sloan. She's the National Staff Coordinator of the Answer Coalition. And of course, for our listeners, I was also and still am the National Coordinator of that coalition. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Talk about September 29th. It was really an amazing experience. We know later in 2002 and then 2003, millions of people came into the streets in the anti-war movement against the invasion of Iraq. The New York Times said that movement was so large, in fact, when it had demonstrations in almost every country on the same day on February 15, 2003, that the Times called it the new global superpower, the second global superpower, meaning the one challenging the U.S. as a superpower. But September 29th was different. That we didn't know what was going to happen. September 11th had just happened 18 days before September 29th. Thousands of people in Washington, D.C. and New York died. Talk about how that happened.
Well, it was extremely clear in the even minutes and hours following the events of September 11th that the Bush administration was going to attempt and most likely successfully to very cynically manipulate those events and people's feelings of grief and confusion after them to carry out what everyone in the anti-war movement really knew, and the many people in the general population knew, was Bush's and the Pentagon's and his administration's true long-standing objectives, which was to carry out new wars of aggression abroad, new interventions, attacks on civil liberties and civil rights at home. And immediately, and actually even though the first new bombing campaign they carried out was in Afghanistan, immediately all of the pundits came on the news and started really agitating for war with Iraq and started talking about trying to associate Iraq with what had happened on September 11th, even though there was actually no connection, and trying to prepare the population to not really for a new war, but a continuation and escalation of the war that was started in 91 by George Bush Sr. and continued under the Clinton administration. And so for those of us in the anti-war and anti-imperialist and peace movement, we knew it was incumbent on us to try to organize opposition to that, organize a response to that, even though the conditions were so difficult and so challenging. And like you said, we had no idea what was going to happen, even though we were working day and night to organize that event. We had no idea really how many people were going to turn out, because there was, even though there was still substantial opposition in the country to the Bush administration and to his pro-war policies, there was a huge amount of fear. People didn't know what would happen.
Let me jump in on that, because I want to emphasize that for our audience. Now, after September 11th, I was in New York City, and you were at that time maybe still in Washington. We were preparing on September 29th for a demonstration against the IMF World Bank. It was part of the anti-globalization movement. But most of the groups canceled the protest after September 11th because they said it's inappropriate under these circumstances, when thousands of Americans have been killed in a terrorist attack, to go out and demonstrate against the president of the United States, whose approval rating at that time, if you can believe it, was 90% after September 11th. Bush, who had lost the election but assumed the presidency, became the most popular president, 90% approval rating. Muslims were being rounded up. There was great hatred directed against the Arab and Muslim world. Answer Coalition was formed on September 14th, 2001, 3 days afterwards. We ourselves had friends and family who are in the World Trade Center, so we shared the same grief and anger and rage and all of it. But we decided, a bunch of us, to go ahead and say, look, Bush is going to, as you said, cynically manipulate the feelings and carry out a foreign policy agenda comporting with the agenda of the neoconservatives, the project of a new American century. And when we did that, when we said we're going to go forward when all the other groups canceled, even a lot of the liberal anti-war people condemned us. Talk about the climate right then and how it felt.
Yes. Well, it's hard to even imagine now at a time that, which is so great, that so many people take part in demonstrations and street protests and are part of different movements. But at that moment, there were actually people pledging in interviews with the Washington Post that they would never organize demonstrations again. And while we were part, we were sort of a anti-imperialist wing of what was a big anti-globalization movement at that time that was anticipating a huge turnout in conjunction with IMF and World Bank meetings. There had been tens of thousands of people in the streets when the IMF, World Bank, World Trade Organization had met at that time in the 2 years preceding. So this was expected to be huge, and we were organizing something that was a part of that. But there was actually a decision even before the IMF and World Bank canceled their meetings taking place at the end of September to cancel all protests against them. And even though the groups that formed the Answer Coalition put out a call to, rather than cancel the protest, make it a protest against war and against racism, some people said they would take no part in that. They would support it in no way. They would provide no resources, even though they had just been in the midst of organizing a demonstration for that same date, you know, on a different but related issue. And a lot of it was out of fear. There was such a huge amount of fear. And even though really the people who were being targeted was not the general population, it wasn't the progressive movement, it was really, as you said, Muslim, South Asian, Arab, Sikh communities, in the progressive movement, there was fear of more widespread repression, and people really didn't want to be in the streets.
Yeah, some of the groups said that they were afraid that if they participated with us in anti-war organizing, the government, the FBI, would come and raid their offices. I mean, it was a climate of fear, unlike what, you know, people who were, say, not part of the first stage of the Cold War had not, you know, sort of experienced firsthand. So 25,000 people came out and they chanted, "War is not the answer. War is not the answer," meaning it wasn't the answer to the terrorist attack. And in fact, those of us who were organizing the demonstration said, you can't really understand the September 11th attacks unless you also understand U.S. foreign policy. Now, some people said that means we became apologists for Osama bin Laden or apologists for Al-Qaeda, apologists for those who were attacking the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Of course, we condemned those terrorist actions. But our point was, if the U.S. occupies Saudi Arabia, which it did after the first Gulf War with tens of thousands of troops, if it continues to carry out the relentless war against the Palestinian people through the agency of the Israeli government, if it continued to impose economic sanctions on Iraq and 5,000 kids per month, according to the UN, were dying from U.S. economic sanctions on Iraq, if the U.S. continued to treat the world as if it was just a stomping ground where the U.S. could put its big military boot wherever it wanted to, if it kept doing that, then eventually the cycle of violence would return back to the shores of the United States. In other words, it was the inevitable process of an imperial aggressive foreign policy. You know, Paul O'Neill, Sarah, said, and he was the Treasury Secretary under Bush, he said at the very first day of the Bush administration, the very first cabinet meeting, that they were talking about the invasion of Iraq. Now, that was back in January or early February 2001, 9 months before September 11th. Obviously, Iraq had nothing to do with September 11th, but it really became the pretext for the invasion of Iraq. And when you look back at it now, 15 years later, when you look back at what the U.S. did and what we tried to stop, and we had demonstrations of hundreds of thousands of people month after month after month by starting in October 2002, when you look back and we said, if you do this in Iraq, the gates of hell will open. The consequences are unanticipatable or unimaginable, but they're going to be bad. When you look back as an organizer, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I think it sort of absolutely, and as you saw by more and more people joining the anti-war movement, you know, what we said at that time was shown to be the case, that really after the immediate aftermath where, like you said, Bush was able to drive up his approval rating, he was trying to get everyone to wrap themselves in the flag and just think in terms of patriotism and not in terms of any kind of logical way. But after that, in a way, it had the opposite effect, because the Bush administration was so aggressive. They were so open about their desire to carry out, as you know, endless interventions and occupations all over the world. They, you know, used these extreme formulations about endless war. And, you know, it sort of took the mask off of the imperialist nature of the U.S. government, and more people actually began joining, and a sort of new generation of people became part of and joined the anti-war movement. And that was, you know, within that year after September 11th, by the fall of 2002, we were seeing large-scale demonstrations you mentioned of many hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people total, taking to the streets to oppose the war in Iraq. So in the end, many more people sort of began to understand that. And of course, you know, it's the only way to logically respond, to look at the root cause of something. One wants to go back and, you know, have an answer to a problem. And I think that sort of post September 11th, there's actually more understanding on the part of people in the United States about the vast array of U.S. bases and troops that are stationed all over the world. And because there was so much exposed about the lies of the different Bush administration officials that they used to justify the Iraq war, there ended up being a greater understanding of, you know, how they justify and how they manipulate people when they, you know, are trying to prepare the population and gain support for a new perspective.
I agree with you on that, because when you think about it, when we all started that organizing for the September 29th, 2001 protest, again, 18 days, just 18 days after the September 11th attack, Bush had an approval rating of 90%. Within a couple of years, 1 million people had signed an online petition demanding Bush be impeached. Millions of people came into the streets. Bush, when he left office with an approval rating of like in the almost the single digits, one of the most unpopular presidents. I mean, all of that turned around. And it was both, of course, the opposition and the resistance inside of Iraq. The Iraqi people didn't run out into the streets and greet the American occupiers like liberators. They didn't put flowers at the end of their rifle barrels. They instead engaged in civil and political and armed resistance against their country being occupied. Iraq, of course, was an ancient civilization, thousands of years old, a proud people. They weren't going to take easily to being dominated and occupied by another country, and especially the United States. There was their resistance, but there was the resistance at home. And that's the thing that the lesson that I think that we want to draw. Eventually, it became easy to join those protests because when millions of people are joining something, it's almost a fad. It's easy. You can say, my whole school is going on a walkout today. I want to be part of this thing. I want to make it happen. But like all big movements, they start as small movements and they start as movements that are minority movements, and they have to buck the tide. They have to go against the social pressure. When we're looking back, Sarah, Iraq, of course, is fragmented. The country, a beautiful country. You've been there. You went with me. We delivered medicine to Iraq in 1998. At that time, the U.S. government threatened to put us on trial and send us to prison for 12 years for trading with the enemy. We brought medicine to Iraq in the 1990s, but we could see then that Iraq was a proud, proud people, that the Iraqis were, that the country was still there in spite of the economic sanctions. Now it's completely fragmented. I mean, and yet there's no accountability for those who did the fragmenting. In other words, Bush, he's unpopular, but he's still running around making speeches and getting paid handsomely for it. What do you think?
Well, that's certainly true. And, you know, not just in Iraq, but in Libya and, you know, many other parts of the world where the U.S. has carried out bombing campaigns, you can see that while they demonize the country and its government for supposedly being some, you know, type of dictatorship, some type of evil incarnation that it was repressing its people. In fact, if you compare the countries that the U.S. demonized pre-bombing and intervention and occupation to today, you'll see that, in fact, it was the U.S. government, its bombs, its intervention, and its toppling of existing organized governments, you know, that led to the fragmentation of countries, that led to the collapse of infrastructure, the collapse of social services. Iraq, in fact, was an extremely developed country, not the way in which people in the United States would generally picture it. People are, you know, this sort of false racist picture is painted in the United States about what other parts of the world are like. But in fact, it was extremely developed. There were advanced, you know, hospitals, infrastructure, schools. There was a relatively high standard of living. And that was just completely destroyed in the Gulf War, in the sanctions that followed, that the Clinton administration continued and escalated. And then in the 2003 invasion. And then since then, we've seen that repeated with U.S. intervention, as I mentioned, Libya, in, you know, many other countries all over the world.
Sarah, we have 2 minutes left, just under 2 minutes. I want to ask you a final question. One thing that seems to me to be an important part of the legacy, too, of the anti-war movement was that the Obama administration, or whatever the next administration is, Republican or Democrat, they are now constrained by anti-war opinion. Like if Obama had said, let's go to Syria, let's send large numbers of troops, the United States, the American public wouldn't accept that. And that's why they have to keep promising as they begin bombing countries, hey, there will be no boots on the ground. That wasn't true 15 years ago. The anti-war movement's legacy has created such a groundswell of anti-war sentiment in the country that it actually functions as a restraint on policymakers. We have 1 minute. I'll give you the last word on that. What do you think?
Well, it's absolutely true. And in fact, that's the impact that the movement against the Vietnam War had in the period following the Vietnam War. It was what Bush Sr. feared when he launched the Gulf War, that there would be so much opposition and so much reaction from the U.S. population that he was afraid to carry out an invasion, occupation. George W. Bush felt that he had overcome that with September 11th. But the anti-war movement is what really reinstilled that in the U.S. population and amongst a new generation. And now I agree absolutely that any new administration, Democratic or Republican, that comes into office is going to have to contend with that. Anti-war sentiment is much more pervasive than, of course, it was in that immediate period after September 11th. And I think it's something that will continue and that will really not be possible for a new administration to overcome.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. 15 years after the first anti-war demonstration, September 29, 2001, the first after September 11th, we now have a change in the political attitudes and sentiment in the country. In the 70s and 80s, it was called the Vietnam Syndrome. Now maybe it's called the Iraq War Syndrome. But it is a restraint on policymakers. That was Sarah Sloan. She's the National Staff Coordinator of the Answer Coalition and one of the lead organizers of the September 29, 2001, a mass protest of 25,000 people. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.